Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
On Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, it's January 21st, 2018. Time is marching on.
Yeah, thank goodness. It's finally warmed up a little bit.
It's warmed up. It's really been pretty nice.
Last couple of days.
The high 50s. The snow has melted.
I'm not complaining. Spring is around the corner.
I don't think so.
So I took Miss Granger out to the movies. We saw Call Me By Your Name yesterday. And how'd you like that?
I liked it.
All right. I liked it too. Let's talk about it for a minute. Call Me By Your Name is the third movie in a trilogy by Luca Guadagnino. And the first two movies were movies that we loved. The first one called I Am Love. The second called A Bigger Splash. Call Me By Your Name is a story, and I've been cautioned not to give too many details, but it takes place in northern Italy. It's about a...
It's a coming-of-age story.
Coming-of-age story. Young man, what do you say, 16, 17?
Dad, let's not go into all the details,
all
okay?
Right.
It's beautiful. It's coming-of-age.
We have to say something.
Let's not get bogged down in plot. It's not about plot. It's about scenery. It's about relationships. People seem to be reluctant to see it because they think it's just a gay relationship movie.
Can we at least say it's a sexual awakening story?
Among other things.
Absolutely. But at the core of it is this young man played by Timothy Chalamet, who's been praised a very great deal, and he deserves it. He's wonderful in the part. And he is attracted to a young scholar who comes to study with his father, a professor. The young scholar played by...
A grad student. Scholar? That's a fancy word.
Okay.
A grad student.
Armie Hammer, who we recall from Social Network, playing both the Winklevoss twins, if you recall.
6'5".
Is he really in real life?
Yes.
6'5"? I will say that he was charismatic in the role, and which is what the role called for.
Yes.
And he is attracted to everybody. Everybody's attracted to this young American.
Very confident.
And that's exactly
but
what
it's really the Chalamet character who's kind of pursuing him.
It's back and forth, but you're absolutely right. But
Let's not be worried that
We're not worried about anything. The fact of the matter is, it is like the other two movies. Italy is a very big part of the film.
It's exquisite.
It's northern Italy,
right.
Part of Italy
it
that we know.
It takes place in a beautiful villa.
That's right.
And allegedly, I have this on the best of authority, Wikipedia.
Yeah, all right.
That... It happened to be a house that the director, Luca Guadagnino, would have loved to buy.
Tried and
failed. But he couldn't afford it.
First of all,
so
let me stop you right there. The idea that directors of these movies can't afford something is a step in the right direction. So already I like that idea. And it's a beautiful house and it's a beautiful setting. And the music is great. Again, all like the other films. So it has a lot going for it. And we recommend it. I will say one thing. It gets a little slow. There is a portion of the movie, maybe let's call it much of the last third of the movie, not all of it, where it just gets a little slow.
Well, some people may see it as slow, and some people may see it as just immersion in the beauty of the moment.
I think a lot of people are seeing it that way. I can only give you my point of view. But it's not as if it goes off the deep end. It comes back, and it comes back in a very nice way. And
yes, in fact, one of the reviews I read points out, and this is Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post, that it has even more heft and meaning in its final transcendent moments, and simultaneously realistic and dreamlike,
I think that's fair. And I think also that reminds me we should mention one other actor, which is Michael Stolberg, who plays the father of the young man and plays into the final scene. And it's a character that surprises you.
We recommend it, but also let's just compare it to the other movie that Chalamet was in. That's also sort of a coming of age
Lady Bird.
Story, Lady Bird, and how different.
Well,
coming of age
this. That's just a very different film. It's just presented a very different way.
And very different family. Yeah. I mean, you know, Lady Bird is all about the back and forth between the daughter and the mom, and they're constantly at odds. And Chalamet's character is completely comfortable with his parents.
Right.
They just adore each other.
Right.
I mean, this is a movie that in many ways is just a total fantasy. The scenery is a fantasy. The house is a fantasy. The family relationship. Oh,
here's another way to look at it. No, that may be a fantasy, or it may just be a different culture, right? It's a, you know, it's a very Italian approach to a lot of things, or a European approach to a lot of things. You might convince yourself that's the way they do it in different cultures. The other movie, Lady Bird, is very much, I won't say small town, but Sacramento is not a big city in California, and a lot of small-mindedness there. A lot of what happens in movies very much derived from time and place. So,
but more than anything... and the director says this, it's a story of a family, not simply a story
of
a gay relationship. Yes, it's not a gay relationship story.
That's interesting.
It's a story of family.
I'll have to think about that one. Because family was just a little... I'm going with what you said a moment ago. It was a little short of realistic. It was a little too smooth, a little too easy. Family's a little tougher than that, I think.
And yet, the way it ends and the way it is all put together in the end
says
strong things about family.
It does. It does. All right. So we're recommending it, but you have to have
Call
patience.
Me by Your
patience.
Name.
Call
and
me
it's
by
based
your
on
name.
A novel. Did you know that?
I did know that.
Okay. It's based on a novel. And James Ivory did the screenplay.
Right.
The screenplay was somewhat adapted.
And produced it.
Because it did, apparently, Hammer... had never done a sex scene before.
Is that right?
In a movie.
Well, I can.
And,
I think there are more sex scenes in his future.
He was also a little concerned about the degree of nudity.
Really?
Originally, it was supposed to have much more nudity, apparently.
Really?
And the whole thing was cut down quite a bit.
Oh, is that right?
For mostly financial concerns, the budget was cut dramatically.
Oh.
And yet, within that, it's
interesting,
terrific, and it also features locations pretty near to where we were on our bike trip in northern Italy this past summer. So that's always a joy.
If we had seen that
to
happen,
those...
I would have snapped that up for you here, but we didn't run across that house. The other thing that's in the news, or one other thing in the news this time of year, is football, NFL football. And we're not going to give you a play-by-play because no one hears the podcast exactly when the games take place. But, of course, we're giving the podcast in the shadow of last week's developments, that shocking development at the end of the Minnesota-New Orleans game. A lot of people probably saw it, in which the Minnesota team snatched victory from the jaws of defeat, or maybe it was the other way around, Orleans snatched defeat.
From the jaws of victory?
From the jaws of victory.
Oh, that's so cute.
Thank you. And the last play of the game was a play that people were kind of too stunned to even explain. I mean, you're watching the play. There's one last shot for the Minnesota team. It seems hopeless. They have to complete a long pass. They throw a long pass. And not do they, it's not just a matter of they complete it, but the player is able to turn and then run the last 30 yards untouched for a touchdown. And you look at that play and you say, what is the possible explanation for that? And
you mean in terms of somebody, nobody tackled him.
Nobody tackled him. How did that happen?
And there were people in the vicinity.
Yes, how did that happen? And the explanation that went forward was that, look, the rookie defender did not make a great play. And he kind of, he missed the tackle, but people miss tackles. And it was a wonderful route by the receiver. And it was a well-conceived play and a beautiful ball. And
well, some people say that who was the defensive guy?
Yeah. I'm purposely not giving his name because he's gotten beaten.
Well, anyway, that they're told in that situation not to commit a penalty, a foul.
I understand, but
interference.
And that's why he didn't block the pass, he didn't tackle. But it doesn't explain why it's a touchdown. Because what happens when you're defending, and the miracle of the play, is that there's no one else on the team tackling. The other 10 guys on defense know all they have to do is tackle the guy in bounds and the game is over. And let me explain why that didn't happen, because no one explained it. This I learned from watching 30 years of NFL football, all right? When you see someone running free in down a field, it means two defenders ran into each other.
Oh.
That's what happened.
So if we
in
look carefully at the,
yes,
at the tapes.
And I have done that for you. What happened was this. Not only did the defender in this play, who will go unnamed, miss the tackle, okay? There was a defender right there who would have made the tackle, but he ran into him and knocked his own player over. That's the only way that play happens, right? Now, no one talks about this because it doesn't serve anyone's interest. The NFL is promoting a high quality of play. It's not the Three Stooges. It's not two guys running into each other. And it's all about brilliant play. And listen, everyone feels bad for the kid who missed the tackle. But that's what happened. Okay. You had two players run into each other. It's one of those wild, crazy plays. Mystery solved. I will say this.
I was up late worrying about
it. No, you
this.
Haven't been sleeping. Okay. Well. Yeah. I will say this. When a team wins a game like that, as Minnesota did, the question is, do they go on and then win their other games because they're on a roll? It's kismet. And the answer is, generally, they don't. Generally, when a team wins a game on a play
by
like
accident,
that, they lose the next game.
But were they winning most of the time? Or?
They were, but they'd fallen behind. Something in the back of their minds in the next game will be telling them in a nagging way, we don't really belong in this field. We don't belong in this game.
I think players always think they... you're picking Philadelphia.
To beat Minnesota.
Minnesota.
And then to get hammered in the Super Bowl. But go ahead.
Okay. All right.
Enough picking. Museum update. I'm eager for the museum update.
You're going to do the ding, ding,
ding? Ding, 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 ding.
Okay, so a couple fun things in the museums mentioned this week, especially in the New York Times. One of them is... an exhibition at the International Quilt Study Center and Museum in Lincoln, Nebraska.
That works. Okay. Lincoln, Nebraska.
Lincoln, Nebraska.
I guess that makes sense.
And it is examples from the quilt collection of your friend and mine, Ken Burns.
Not surprised.
The man collects quilts. He has like 75.
Really?
Some in storage and some scattered in his office, in his lake house, et cetera.
In
his
barn,
his home. No, you can't have too many quilts, apparently. Quilts are not such the big deal. People were much more excited about quilts, I would say, 15 or 20 years ago. They were, now it's not so much about collecting them as antiques, as visual, but more as visual.
People show him up on the wall. In the article you have here, he's got it on the wall. As opposed
right. He sees them. He is not looking at them as quaint mementos of the past so much as fabulous examples of modernist geometric design. Okay, these ladies somewhere are sewing these amazing quilts. At the same time that earlier, really, than... artists like he here cites Mondrian and his abstract geometric patterns. Yeah. And it's really true. I mean, if you Google around, you can see other quilts he owns. One's a spectacular star quilt with a star shape made of little stars and quilted with even more stars. So they're quite visually stunning. And what I will say is I saw... with Cindy Gompert, who has been our guest on this show, a fantastic quilt show at the Park Avenue Armory back in 2011. It was extraordinary, and it was an extraordinary installation. Visually, just amazing. That was an exhibition of... I think something like 650 quilts, and they were hung in the enormous armory that is the 7th Regiment Armory on Park between 66th and 67th, which is currently housing the Winter Antiques Show, which has some fun quilts and other... fun items, including a nice booth from the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts down in Richmond, which is a terrific little museum in a terrific little city.
Have you been to that museum?
Yes, I have. I've even been a member over the years.
What?
It's just a great little museum.
You've been a member?
I've been a member.
You gave them money?
Well, yes, I give them money every year.
Oh,
it's a great little museum.
Yeah.
They have a nice exhibition there. And, you know, you should, any reason you get to go to the Park to go in the Park Avenue Armory is worth it. It is a spectacular building.
We're back to New York now.
Yes, we're back to New York.
Yeah.
But you can go in there and see.
I think I've played basketball there. Is that possible?
I don't know.
I think it's a
huge barn like, you know.
They've hosted some basketball tournaments where they set up like six basketball
Okay,
courts.
You did not play basketball in the rooms that were, I think, designed by Tiffany, your friend Stanford White, the pedophile, Herder Brothers, Candace Wheeler, who was a designer for Tiffany. It has amazing rooms. And you can go for tours there. So, it would also be fun to go to the antique show. It's, you know, it's not the kind of antique show where you pick up cute things for your house. I mean, this is very high end.
Yeah. So we don't bet on that.
You know, we went to the show 100 years ago and you saw some football player.
Yeah, Tucker Fredrickson.
Tucker Fredrickson, you ran
into. Of course I remember that.
Okay.
I can go on about Tucker Fredrickson if you want, but I won't.
You know, it's high end.
Tucker Fredrickson is a very classy guy, but another time. I will say that my contribution to the museum update is in finding an article about short-term hotel stays in New York. In
other Which words, I really appreciate.
Renting by the hour.
Not just renting by the hour.
Yeah.
There are several different apps. You know, the museums don't seem interested in figuring out how to rent for really short stays.
Right.
But other people have.
Right.
And there, you know, hotels have a 3-hour or 4-hour minimum. There's a new app called Recharge, I guess recharge.com probably, that actually you can rent by the minute.
Yeah.
So through this app, you can dart into the Pierre for 20 minutes.
But just so we're clear, and by the minute might be 50 cents a minute, dollar a minute.
Well, there's an upfront charge
$30 to $50
on the hotel.
Right.
And but then it's 50 cents to $2 a minute.
Right.
You can use it however you wish.
All right. So stop right there. So the point is, because short-term hotel space have a bad reputation, but what we're talking about here is...
bad in I mean, not salacious. Everybody thinks it's bad.
Salacious. But my point
salacious.
Is... My point is...
Yeah.
We're talking about you're in the city for a day and you have a lot to do and then you have a couple hours downtime and you want to organize yourself.
Right. Or take a shower.
Yeah.
Change your clothes. Yeah. Change somebody's diaper.
Yes.
Yes.
Who knew?
So, you know.
Who knew? Well, look, I had no idea they did that kind of thing.
But it's nice that it's by the minute because you're locking into 4 hours.
Right.
I mean, maybe you need 4 hours. Maybe you want 4 hours to chill.
Well, the person who wrote the article said it was great for her to do a 20-minute stay, 25-minute stay.
Yeah, apparently it really works.
And it cost her $50 and changed her whole day. So there you go. So I ran into something which I just stunned me. It might have stunned me more than it stunned you, but I'll just read the beginning of the article. And this, I'm reading this kind of wide-eyed. It's in the Times. It says, when Maria Callas appeared on stage at the Rose Theater at Jazz at Lincoln Center on Sunday night, she looked a little pale, a little spectral. This was understandable, perhaps. She's been dead since 1977.
So what
are we talking about?
What are we really talking about?
So Maria Callas, again, in some people's view, was the greatest singer of the 20th century and opera singer. And she's been gone for some time. But
she was the one who was married to...
Some Greek zillionaire. I'm going to say before he married
Aristotle Jack Onassis.
Yeah, Aristotle Onassis.
Some Greek zillionaire?
Yeah, well, there's more than one. There's plenty to go around, but yes. But in any event, is it Maria Callas? I think it is Maria Callas. But I know her more as a singer than a spouse.
Well, you know her.
But my point is... And as a hologram. Here's my point. They're doing a performance with a hologram. And they're not doing it in any strange place. They're doing it in Lincoln Center. People are coming into Lincoln Center and sitting down and saying, here we have Maria Callas, and a hologram comes on, and the hologram sings. Right?
Like you've never seen Star Trek?
What do you mean Star Trek? Star Trek's a movie. This is a hologram. I mean,
it's a TV show.
They're creating people. Oh, yeah, that's true. But they're creating people. I mean, this is crazy. So where is this going? I mean, they're going to recreate dead people in a sense that you think that's really them up on the stage. It's several steps beyond a movie. As the Times says, it was amazing, yet also absurd. Strangely captivating, yet also campy. And ridiculous.
You sound like one of the natives who's afraid to have his daguerreotype made because he feels the machine has captured his soul inside.
Don't get me wrong. It's not that I'm concerned that there's going to be a Dan Abuhoff hologram up in Lincoln Center anytime soon.
I think it would be fabulous. Years from now, somebody will say, and look, do you want to meet your great-grandpa?
Well, it would be fabulous, perhaps even preferable to the original. But my point is still, it's just mind-boggling to me that you're going to have performances, and you clearly are, by holograms of dead performers.
How is this very different from a CD or
different.
A vinyl?
Just
different. It's just visual.
It's just look. They've already, just so we're clear on what's going on, they've developed a hologram of Tupac Shakur, Michael Jackson, Roy Orbison. This was a double bill. Well, first of all, who goes to Lincoln Center to see Maria Callas and Roy Orbison? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it was a 30-minute experiment, if you will, and they're going to expand it to full concert length, and they're starting a tour in May in Tokyo.
Okay, so soon you'll be able to maybe pay zillions of dollars to go see Springsteen live, or you can pay $12.95 to see his hologram.
Or I'll see a hologram of Tucker Fredrickson, maybe. That would be enough for me. But look, all right. I'm thrown by this. You are less thrown.
I think it's fine, but
I don't know. I'm not prepared. But I know you had something about child prodigies.
Really?
Yes, that was your next step.
Well, there's a book out by Anne Hulbert, mm-hmm. Off the Charts, The Hidden Lives and Lessons of American Child Prodigies. So, there's lots of reasons to read it. Some of the stories are not so happy. As you may surmise, mm-hmm. that many people who start out as child prodigies don't make it into adulthood intact for a variety of reasons.
And they don't become adult geniuses either.
No. Right. So she kind of details various stories of, what happens to people and why. And she does it in an interesting way that really puts them in their own personal context. Mm-hmm. There are often particular reasons for why some people become superstar prodigies and others don't. For instance, she talks about Bobby Fischer, mm-hmm. and great chess player, great, part of the excitement there was America's sort of anxiety about creeping Soviet domination in education and science. And she sees his sort of success partly related to an example of one era's prodigy is another's anonymous misfit.
Wait a minute. So her point is that he was made a bigger deal of than he might have been otherwise?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he was a misfit. I'll go with that. Uh-huh. He clearly was highly troubled.
Some other interesting stories are interesting in their own light, but also kind of serving an example to parenting in general, mm-hmm. parenting normal children, and the idea that in many of these circumstances, kids were not able to divorce themselves from those overweening parents who helped develop them as superstars mm-hmm. in their area. And like it or not, sooner or later, you have to become your own person, and many often the kids weren't prepared for that. She is basically saying what these kids need and want, what all kids need and want, is the chance to obsess in their own idiosyncratic terms, sweat and swerve, lose their balance, get their bearings, balance loneliness, discover resilience. She cautions parents to hold the children accountable, help them thrive, but if they, that is, the parents, try to re-engineer the fundamentals of their offspring, they will fail spectacularly sooner or later. She also points out that genius is an abnormality, and abnormalities do not come one at a time. Many gifted kids have ADD, OCD, or Asperger's.
That's interesting. Yeah, so.
And parents are quick to acknowledge the positive, but very often they are in denial about these other aspects. And she does point out that a lot of teachers fail to appreciate creativity and critical thinking in their own students. She has a lot of good stories about small geniuses being kicked out of places of learning. That I definitely believe. We have a great, in many respects, a great public education system, but it really depends on efficiency and homogeneity to succeed, and that doesn't include those who stand out.
But I think the clear point, I think this has been clear for a while, but it's not obvious, and I think we will, well, a lot of us have come to realize it surprisingly, is that, you know, early growth and development, you know, in terms of intellectual growth, doesn't necessarily portend continued development. And the people who are the best and brightest and the apparent geniuses, be it musically or anywhere else, by the age of 15 or 18, don't continue on the same trajectory. It's hardly unusual.
And even if they do, the problem is dealing with life.
Yeah, well, but that may be the reason.
What succeeds as being a musical prodigy doesn't necessarily allow you to be comfortable with people in high school, in social situations. The same obsessive behavior doesn't necessarily
I will tell you, this goes way back, and I don't want to take you too far off this article, but I was reading an article about John Stuart Mill, who some think was the greatest genius of all time, who was raised to be a prodigy. His father took him away from dealing with all the other children because he didn't want him to be contaminated by the hoi polloi. And there was no one smarter ever than John Stuart Mill. And he reached a crisis when he was 18 or something, when he was very young, and it could have gone either way. And he happened to get over it and become a highly functioning intellectual going forward. But it was touch and go. It wasn't easy for him. So.
And in the summary of the review I read, actually states Hulbert's central finding, which applies really to everyone, children's needs change. If you think you've got a child figured out, you will be proved wrong momentarily.
Well, kidding.
Children in the end flout our best and worst intentions. So the book is off the charts, The Hidden Lives and Lessons of American Child Prodigies by Ann Hulbert. Also in the Wall Street Journal, they have Ann Hulbert recommending a bunch of books by and about child prodigies, including Child Star by Shirley Temple Black, written when she was in her 60s, with some interesting stories. And then another book, Composition in Black and White by Catherine Talalé, about pianist Philippa Schuyler, whose father was African American, mother was white, and they really cultivated her to showcase her talents in what they called a hybrid vigor. And then also a novel by Vladimir Nabokov called The Defense, and an interesting book by an ex-prodigy, Norbert Wiener, whose best-selling Cybernetics, or Control and Communication in the Animal and the Machine, won him attention in 1948, who is written about by Hulbert as well. So, you know, if you're interested in gifted and talented and prodigies, those are some things you might want to look at.
Okay. Baseball analytics. That attracts its... Yeah, here's the problem with baseball analytics. Let's talk about what they are. Sabermetrics. So a lot of people feel that the way that baseball...
Is this sabermetrics?
Sabermetrics. S-A-B-R-E metrics.
All right, like a sword?
Exactly right. Sabermetrics.
So it's meant to cut through all the nonsense?
The word is sabermetrics.
Okay.
That's all I can tell you. So
we don't know the etymology of it?
We don't, and we don't care. But
okay, unlike Call Me By Your Name,
where they care about
where they go into etymology quite a bit.
All right, well, there we go. Yet another divergence between our lives and Call Me By Your Name. The point is sabermetrics, which is the analytical study of baseball, and what it's supposed to do is bring some kind of mathematical rigor to managing and general managing baseball, and change the way decision making is done, to change the way the players are positioned, to change the way that you put in a relief pitcher, or who bats as a pinch hitter, all these kind of things. By bringing statistical analysis, the promise is to have a much better baseball team.
Okay, so you just use data.
Exactly, it's data-driven.
You don't care about anything else.
Well, it is. You don't necessarily have to use it that way, but if you were to stick with sabermetrics and nothing else, you would be data-driven.
Even though you're saying, I don't really like this guy's attitude, or he seems like a weirdo, if the numbers say...
Yeah. But it's more fundamental than that, because baseball is a game in which, you know, it's old hands. It's a matter of people who use a lot of tribal wisdom and experience and say, this is the way we did it in 1937. This
and we've talked about that before, the tension between old school and this new, you know, big data approach.
So they have a picture in the Times of a couple in Hagerstown, Maryland, who is sitting there with their mouths open, watching in horror as the team for which they are advisors, and that team is in a Mexican league, it's a Mexican team, ignores their advice, ignores the sabermetrics advice, and puts up the wrong pinch hitter, the wrong relief pitcher, and notwithstanding that their consultants there continue to be ignored. And the article, strangely enough, is about their, you know, dismay about being ignored and having their valuable advice put aside while these Mexicans play baseball the old-fashioned way. Now, this raises many questions, including why were they hired?
No, people hire consultants all the time and don't listen to their findings.
Yeah, but look, let me just put it simply without going into great detail. I'm with the Mexicans. I mean, this is like an episode of The Twilight Zone to think
that. How do you know you're with the Mexicans? I thought
you were a sabermetrics guy. There are limits. I read a book, happened to be called The Only Rules It Has to Work. And The Only Rules It Has to Work is a book about just this type of experiment. It's written by a couple guys named Ben Lindbergh and Sam Miller. They had a team that they advised in California, an independent league team. And they brought all their sabermetrics to bear. And
did it work?
No, not particularly well. Because
So what's the book about?
The book is about their experiment, how they tried to impose their
And it didn't work?
Not in my mind. I mean, look, there's so much more going on.
But haven't some of the teams achieved great success by...
You have to pick and choose. You have to know what you're going to use from the sabermetrics.
So you have to be both the old school guy who has some gut feeling, who has some intuition about it, and be able to factor in
the principal way.
How do you know which data? How do you know?
How do you use judgment to do it?
How do you know which data to use and depend on and rely on?
You have to make a judgment as to what you're going to go. Look, the principal way that you help a baseball team succeed, if you are the manager, frankly, the principal way you help any organization succeed is by developing talent, is by making people better. Not looking about what they did in the last 15 years and predicting what they're going to do based on what they did the last 15 years. You do it by making people better. And that's what managers who are successful actually do. And that goes beyond the limits of data-driven decision-making, okay? And that, to me, is what you have to understand if you're managing a team. So these folks in Hagerstown, Maryland, don't particularly impress me.
So you say that these people can't tell you what to do, partly because they don't know anything about real baseball? They haven't played?
I didn't say
do you
that
need
at all.
That factor?
I think that's all useful, but that's not what I said. What I said was, you can't predict the future by looking at the past entirely. I think that's number one. Yes, beyond that, you do have to have a feel for people. And there are many, many things that go in decision making that you have no data on.
But there's probably a purpose for somebody who's pulling data together.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily know how to use it.
Look, if you're the manager, you want everything, including the data. But then you have to make a decision. It's very useful in positioning your infielders. It's very useful in figuring out who your relief pitchers are in particular situations, but there's much more involved in managing than that. So it's art and science combined, and it's probably more art than science.
So we just hope it's not their day job.
I'm not worried about them particularly. Okay. They look like they have a nice place.
I don't know, that's sectional.
I love sectional.
I'm not into that.
Yeah.
Anyway, travel update. If you're going to Prague,
we've been to Prague.
On a bike trip. That's where we get everywhere, just because of bike trips.
Yeah.
And the Horloge is being repaired. the big clock,
yeah.
The cool clock,
right.
In the middle of town. 600-year-old clock, first started up in 1410, mm-hmm. Is being repaired. So that's kind of a big project. It originally had all, I think, wooden mm-hmm. workings inside. Over time, much of it has been replaced with metal, etc. And this fella, Peter Scala, is going to take it back. As much as possible to its original state and make it, keep it functional. It's an amazing clock. It tracks old Bohemian time when the day begins with sunset, mm-hmm. Babylonian time, which tracks the day from sunrise to sunset, Central European time, star time. It has a calendar that notes the days of the week, month, and year, a ring that shows the path of the zodiac, and also it has an astrolabe, okay, which actually shows the position of the sun, moon, and stars, and was an essential tool for astronomers and mariners dating back to antiquity. So this is quite and it has fascinating characters on it. You may remember sort of personifications of pride, envy, avarice, etc., who do various things. So it's a big job. Sounds like a tricky job, but sounds like also that Peter Scala is the guy.
He's also determined to go back to some wooden parts as opposed
right.
to metal parts.
Right.
He's going to make
it
more authentic.
The original, yeah.
Well, look, I do remember there's a big crowd watching that clock all the time, and it's mostly 18-year-old kids who have had too many Pilsners.
No, it's not. The tourists gather there
see
it.
All right.
And, Prague is kind of an amazing place. You're right. The beer is cheap.
Yeah.
The food is pretty cheap, too, and terrific. Remember those houses with the big pieces of meat?
Yeah.
And you'd see these terrific young Asian tourists chowing down.
Yeah.
You think of them eating sushi yeah. in a very delicate way, or ramen noodles or yeah. something, and here are these kids chowing down on the meat. One of my favorite buildings in Prague, do you remember the Prague Municipal House where we saw a concert?
Yeah,
built in 1912. Beautiful. Exquisitely beautiful Art Nouveau mm-hmm. Design, and just nothing municipal about it.
Oh, yeah,
just,
that was an unbelievable building. Unbelievable. Yeah, they must use municipal in a different way than we use municipal.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite this beautiful during the communist occupation.
It was pretty bizarre. So just a quick note, the Mets, who are making their own contributions to developing baseball teams, have announced the re-signing of Jay Bruce. The Mets have a different approach to baseball. I just think it's worth noting. We can all consider it, in the fullness of time, which is to put on the field this year the exact same team they put on the field last year, which is, pretty good plan, except for the fact they came in pretty much last place next year. So last year.
So you're skeptical.
I don't understand the logic behind that exactly, but they're doing it with great enthusiasm. I do have I will say this about Jay Bruce. He was... he has an apartment right near my office.
Well, did you find out if he sold that?
No, I'm sure.
I feel like somewhere,
yeah, no,
it's
I'm
on
sure
the edge of my consciousness.
No. He didn't sell it.
You expect to see him on
here's
the street
my,
corner.
Well, here's the real...
You expect to see him at the local ramen shop.
This is my point. Point is I can see his apartment from my office. And the story is, in the middle of the summer, in late July, I was coming back after picking up something to eat for lunch from the Whole Foods, which is at the block north. And as I walked back, I bumped into somebody, the other guy went flying, of course. And it turns out it was Jay Bruce. But it didn't occur to me at the time. It took a second for it to register. So I kept walking south. He kept walking north. And it occurred to me,
Jay Bruce. He's not going to speak to
then
you.
No, I didn't expect him. So I turned around. Here's the question.
Yeah.
Once I realized it was him, do I jog after him and say, Jay, I didn't recognize you. You're having a great season. And I said to myself, I'm a New Yorker. I can't do that kind of stuff. I can't be running across.
You could have apologized for knocking him across the sidewalk.
Right, well, that was a joke.
Yeah, that would have been nice.
He's 6'4", 230 pounds. It didn't exactly work that way. But my point is that I said to myself, look, I can't be running across Second Avenue to catch this guy. I'll see him No, I'll see him soon enough. That night he got traded to the Indians.
And he left.
And he left. But now he's back. He's back.
So your buddy Jay is back.
I'm looking forward to a summer with Jay Bruce.
You guys can lunch together, perhaps.
Exactly. He'll be at the cafeteria before you know it.
All right, just a couple more things.
Yes.
Face yoga.
Yeah.
So New York Times had an article a little while ago. And it turns out some dermatologists at Northwestern University said, you know, there are all these ads for these regimens you can do to fix your face. Because our faces tend to sag over time. Mm-hmm. And so there are videos, instruction manuals, all kinds of things that claim to rejuvenate your facial features if you do them. So some dermatologists at Northwestern University decided to actually do a study, like a scientific study.
Right.
And they put together, with help from one of these programs, the seemingly one of the more successful ones, a 30-minute program. They got 27 women to sign up to do it.
Yeah.
30 minutes a day.
Yeah.
Every single day of the week. And they had them do it for 8 weeks, and they took a picture at the beginning before, then at 8 weeks, and then another 12 weeks, and they took a final picture. Almost half of the participants dropped out. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a lot to do, 30 minutes.
Well, here's the question. How did it work? Did it work?
It worked okay.
Yeah.
That when they had dermatologists look at the pictures of the people, they did say they looked on average 3 years younger at the end of it.
All right.
It seemed most successful. They couldn't identify any real changes. They think mostly the cheeks look better, look fuller.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the point is, it's non-toxic, self-administered, and inexpensive.
Yeah, well,
so if you want to, you can, you know,
still got
to
work.
Google face yoga
of
the New York Times and get an idea of a couple of these exercises. But a lot of them seem to involve pulling up your corners of your mouth in a smile. So maybe we should just smile more.
Yeah, it's not so easy for some of us, but yes,
and,
got it.
You know, this kind of stuff's been around for a while. I remember the Jack LaLanne show. Jack LaLanne had some exercises you should do. So nothing is new under the sun. But finally, here's a fun story. Or it's sort of a sad story, but it's, you know, pretty darn interesting.
Yeah.
This week in New York, a man, Sean Waters, was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Okay, for trading a tortoise. Trading a tortoise for a turtle.
Hmm.
Did you know that was worthy of 6 months of jail?
Well, there must be more to it. But...
Well, actually, back on July 17th, somebody cut the fence at the Alley Pond Environmental Center in Queens.
Right.
A place popular with children.
Right.
And stole a tortoise named Millennium. A big thing. Weighs like 95 pounds or something.
Right.
And carted it away.
Right.
Sean, a turtle lover. Now, do you know the difference between a turtle and a tortoise?
Because
I didn't.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Tortoise lives only on land.
Right.
Turtles go in the water. Live at least part of the time in water.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so anyway, Sean Waters lives in Queens, 37 years old, loves turtles, doesn't have any big turtles, only small ones, but does have some, actually came across whoever stole the turtle or freed the turtle, the tortoise, on the street, and a deal was struck. Waters ended up with the tortoise.
Mm-hmm.
He realizes that he can't take it home. His mother won't allow it. So he ends up answering an ad on Craigslist for someone who wanted to sell a turtle. So he calls him up and they work out a trade. This guy's in Connecticut. They work out a trade. They will trade the tortoise for a turtle and $300. And the environmental center people say, you know, the tortoise is probably really has a street value of about $2,500. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, Waters doesn't have a car. He's in Queens. Mm-hmm. He takes the tortoise in the shopping cart on the Metro North to Fairfield, Connecticut, mm-hmm. and turns it over to the other guy, well, who later sees news reports saying that this tortoise is missing. And so he contacts the police, and they track Waters down, and he ends up getting arrested, losing his job, losing his license as a security guard, and being sentenced to 6 months for fifth-degree criminal possession. He pleads guilty. And he's heading off to jail on Rikers. His mother is very upset. She says, "He's not a murderer or a drug dealer. He's an animal lover. That's really his downfall." So there you have it, the downfall of an animal lover.
So I still don't get this story. He's going to jail because he had a tortoise and you're not supposed to have a tortoise.
He had criminal possession of a tortoise.
Yeah, but he didn't steal the tortoise.
I'm not a lawyer, Daniel. This is your department.
Okay.
But the man, you know, he's an animal lover. He's going to jail.
Something?
It's kind of a sad story.
This is the kind of story someone's going to pick up and they'll get him out of jail in a couple of weeks because something's missing in this story, honestly. Doesn't make sense to me. Let's hope he gets out of jail. How's that?
Okay. All right. Is that all we got?
Yeah. So we're going to close with something. One of our favorite shows is Mozart in the Jungle.
And we exhort you
to watch Mozart,
Mozart in the Jungle.
And aside from being a great
show. Based on the memoirs of an oboist in New York.
Right. And not only is it, you know, a fascinating show and it surprises us all the time, but the music's good. And we're not classical music aficionados by any stretch of the imagination. But sometimes we hear a piece of music and we go, wow, that's really something. So we thought we'd play such a piece of music for you to just close out. And you and what it is, it's called Danzón Number 2. It is by a Mexican composer named Arturo Marquez. It is performed by the Simón Bolívar Orchestra, which is Venezuelan, which is a youth orchestra. It's conducted by Gustavo Dudamel, who, by no coincidence, perhaps, is the conductor. He is, I should say, the conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, but he's the person who the character in Mozart in the Jungle is based on. The great Rodrigo is based on Gustavo Dudamel, and he is played in Mozart in the Jungle by Gael Garcia Bernal. You'll get a sense of this, and it's well worth your time. We're just going to give you a couple minutes of it.
We leave you with this. Talk to you next week.
Right, and that's it. See you next week for Tamps and Dan Read the Paper.